The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, listeners. Thank you for joining me today, Saturday, October 5th, 2013. This program is streaming live right now from the White Network, and you can listen to all my new programs on our live stream by going to thewhitenetwork.com and checking out the upper right side of the page. I'm expecting Bradley Smith, founder of CODO, the Committee on Open Debate for the Holocaust, to call in the beginning of the second hour, and I hope he does. I think he will. I'm pretty sure he will. I've sent him a reminder, but with Bradley, you never know what might come up, and yesterday he had to make one of those drives to the other side for some important to him business. I don't mean it wasn't important, but it's not earth-shakingly important, but it's important to him. So in any case, today my subject is the Holocaust myth, otherwise known by people in the know as the hoax. And we people in the know are fortunate to have a new book that's just come out. And I'm going to talk about this book in this first hour. I'm pretty excited about it. The title is The Extermination Camps of Action Reinhardt. The subtitle, An Analysis and Refutation of Facetious Evidence, evidence is in quotation marks, Deceptions and Flawed Argumentation of the Holocaust Controversy's Bloggers. And the book is by Carlo Mattonio, Thomas Cuse, Jürgen Graf, three men who have worked together before and have put out lots of very good work. Now, if you don't know who the Holocaust Controversy's bloggers are, then you're not totally in the know. But probably most of you do, but there is a website called holocaustcontroversies.blogspot, I think it is, .com or whatever. And you can find them on there. And they are five men who have set themselves up as promoting the official Holocaust version of events, and nobody in the Holocaust industry accepts them or likes them or ever mentions them or really joins in with them. So this tells you a lot about them. They're as our authors say, their main method of how to go about all this is cut and paste, and they go through any new book or work or whatever by any Holocaust revisionist, particularly the more well-known, the better, and they look for some little kind of mistake or something that they can point out to say, oh, look, he said this here, and then over here he said that, and then make that out like it just completely negates everything that's being said. And while they themselves, in the posts that they write that are, of their own making, just tell lies and don't investigate anything, pass on things that without any evidence, and accept all witness, witness testimony, survivor testimony, and so on. And they're also very rude and even obscene in the language that they use. When I was doing something, I forget what, they were going after me quite a bit. And, oh, I know, I was writing about Joachim, I can't think of his last name now. I was writing some refutations to somebody who posted some things on their blog. And so they took out after me. They were calling me all kinds of four-letter words and names. But they're just a joke, these guys. So I thought when Matonio, Cuse, and Graf, who are very well-versed, I mean, they well-studied and respectable Holocaust revisionists, said they were going to spend all this time writing this reputation to these guys, because these guys had written a book, well, they called it a book. I think it was only online, in which they attacked these three men in their books about Action Reinhardt, the Action Reinhardt camps, which are Treblinka, Sobibor, and Belzec. And they have written books on these camps, individual books, our writers, Matonio, Cuse, and Graf, particularly Matonio and Graf. And so they wrote this thing that they called, and I don't even have the name of their book right here in front of me, but they wrote this thing, 570 pages or so it was. And this is what Matonio and Graf called that with their cut and paste method. You know, they don't do any real research. They just look things up on the internet and stick things here and there. So these men felt they had been attacked and they needed to refute what was said, and so they decided to do it, and it turned out to be a pretty long project, more than they had anticipated in the beginning, because they went into a lot of areas that they maybe had not covered so well in the past, and they say now they have in this 1,500 page volume that they've written, which I just told you the title, Extermination Camps of Action Reinhardt, is online, and it's online. It's only going to be online, at least for the time being, as far as I know. So you don't have to go out and buy it. And I've already talked about and advertised the pages that where you can find it and so on, and I'll do so again. And if you go to, it's all on the CODO website. And so you go there and find it there too. But not to get lost in this part of it, they went into new areas, and they say now that they have a better bunch of information, or a better case against the Action Reinhardt camps being extermination camps than they had even before, and they thought they had a good enough one then. So they think it's been very beneficial, the whole process, and I have been reading it. Of course, I haven't gotten all that far in it, but I'm very happy with what I've been reading, and here's my take on it, that because they're refuting these five clowns, this is Muhlenkamp, Terry, yeah, it's his last name, Terry, Romanov, and Harrison, and then there's the fifth one who I've never been too familiar with, and I'm not sure of his name right now, and I'm not looking at their names. So because they're refuting what these guys have written, these guys are not respectable, even as official Holocaust historians, in quotes, are not really respectable, but they appear in the world as respectable, and they're taken seriously. And so our revisionists have always tried to, in answering their claims and so on, tried to be respectful of them and, write in turn in a way that looked over their arguments and then, went about answering them. I didn't call them names or, speak insultingly about them at all. And I'm not saying they are doing that now with these guys, but they are speaking much more plainly, and they've taken the gloves off quite a bit more, I think. And while they're not being in any way offensive, they're coming right out with it, that these writers don't have any kind of a case whatsoever. And and then they go after it and say why and so on. So it's an easier, it's a more fun read for me. I mean, I like this style. I like this tougher style very much. And so I'm enjoying it, and I'll give you some examples of that in a minute. I want to say in further introduction of all this that these three men are about the only true revisionists still working, still producing work at this time. I mean, revisionist scholars. There are a lot of revisionists, and it's all, you know, a lot of good work being done, but it's not of the type that is actually goes and discovers information and can put it all together and knows all the languages and goes to these men have gone to in all of the camp memorial places, the so-called concentration campsites. They've gone to huge numbers of archive places in person, you know, where they keep all this information, and, you know, libraries and so on. They're the serious ones. And when they say something, they've got it all referenced and sourced and backed up, and there's no question about what they're saying. They're not just throwing. And so they do all this work, and mostly with little support, financial or otherwise, from the vast numbers of European people on whose behalf they labor so diligently. We're fortunate that these three are still working at it. And it is my understanding that they are going to now be tackling this Einsatzgruppen topic. And I think they're aware. I don't know this for a fact, but it seems to me that they're aware that they're the only ones doing this, and they won't be around forever, so they want to get as much done in this whole movement of the Holocaust from Auschwitz and gas chambers and into the interior of Russia and the Holocaust by bullets, so, you know, as it's called, and then these Action Reinhardt camps, which they've been working on, and, you know, get into all of these things that haven't been really focused on yet. And so I really appreciate that they're doing that, and I hope that you can talk to other people about this, and you'll all try to read this, because it's really, you're going to find it's very, very interesting. And if there's parts that are too technical, you can just skip them. You just skip by them. So I'll go into that a little bit more in a minute. Get some support going for these men, if it's at all possible to do so. So, you know, it's the same sad story. It's a sad story of our failures, because they're working for, what they're doing is for the benefit of the vast numbers of European people. But these European peoples of ours are not, you know, reciprocating. We're actually working, most are working on the other side. So that's a very sad story of our failure to recognize our own best interests and to act in our best interests. Now, the Holocaust myth makers, or hoaxers, as I'm calling them, not just these five clowns, but you know, the ones who are taken seriously. And it's not even them, but it's just the elite, both the government, elites of the governments and all the Western and European American, Western Hemisphere nations, but also the elites and also the Jewish interests, the international Jewry, are not letting up at all on the Holocaust. In fact, they've picked up on it. They're working very, very hard to keep it from going out of sight, from people forgetting about it. They're working maybe harder than ever. They feel they have to. And they are, seems to me they've been putting their attention on Eastern European states in the last few years. And because these states have been more independent-minded in about these matters, and they have populations with mixed feelings about these matters. Now, where do I have all those states listed? Oh, here they're coming up. Okay. They have they have mixed feelings because of their long, miserable occupation under the Soviet Union. And it taught them that it's not a one-sided issue, you know, between the free ally, the, you know, democracy-pushing allies and the dictatorial Nazis. So they have not passed in these most of these countries the kind of draconian laws against anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial in Central Europe has. And it really is those two things that are at the heart of what they're trying to do to outlaw anti-Semitism and to outlaw Holocaust denial and to enshrine the Holocaust as the most terrible event that ever took place in the history of mankind, and as the epitome of genocide, and to memorialize it everywhere forever as that. And so this has, I'm not going to go into today the kind of deleterious effect it has on white Europeans, but I'm going to go on to say that I've noticed that these major Jewish organizations have been regularly visiting the politicians and the parliaments in Hungary, in Romania, in Greece, in Croatia, Ukraine, Bulgaria, and also in the Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, urging them, this is for the past few years, but especially lately too, urging them to pass Holocaust denial and anti-Semitism laws because they tell them that they're shaming themselves by not doing so and by allowing what they call fascists and extremist political parties what they call extremist organizations, memorial organizations, say, you know, soldiers from World War II or fighters who were fighting the Soviets in their country and so on, that this is considered an extremist fascist organization, and they should not be allowed to exist in their countries, they say. They must all be stamped out. This is what they're after. And they're, you know, they've got, there are certain politicians in these countries that go along with them, that help them out. And then there are those who are trying to resist. And, but this is, seems to me where their effort is, because they've already got the Western, the more Western part of the hemisphere, all, Europe and also, the Western hemisphere in America. The America is all tied up and, you know, without any peep of objection at all. Of course, what they're after is to blot out any record of history that's not according to their version of events. And this is the really scary part, because if you think it can't happen, you're living in la-la land. I'm sure it can happen, and it has happened, and it's happened in the past. And our real history in this era that we or our parents or grandparents have been a part of, that we are, you know, consider our modern era, not contemporary maybe, but our modern era, could be just totally unrecognizable. It's already partially so, but you can still get the other side. But the time can come when you cannot get the other side at all, only one side. And the internet can be wiped out in an instant, which is a concern. Because so much is on the internet. And the only way, but there, people may have no ways to not allow that to, keep stuff in certain memory banks. I'm not sure about all that, but, and maybe that's being done. But anyway, the only way I see is to win politically. And I've talked about this previously, that the role the Holocaust myth plays in the current dominance of the New World Order. And the ultra-left vision of the, which is their vision is the end of all nationalism and of the mixing of the genetics of all people and a boundary-free world, except for the boundaries that separate the elites from the common people. I don't think this is a conspiracy theory or a far-out fanatical idea at all, because we see it going on. So what do we find in this new book? Well, you know, as I already indicated to you, it's not just more of the same. I think it was, and I've already indicated to you that it was written in a different style, a little bit lighter style. They may have known that another big book on this that people aren't going to read, some heavy, you know, thing full of details about numbers and figures and so on. So they've kept that to a minimum. Of course, what's necessary to be there is there. But as I said, you can skip over some of that if you're not into getting into that much deep. That, you know, it has to be there as to show that what they're saying, there's something to back it up. You know, it has to be there. But you can, a lot of it is in italic, and you can see where the more bold type is. You can just glance at it and move on, because it can take, you can always go back, you know, and go over things. But just to get an idea of the whole scope of the book, you don't want to be stopped right in the beginning. So I think it's basically, I would say that the whole book is basically about debunking nonsense, the nonsense that's spouted by the hoaxers in support of their myth. And this makes it, it's made it more, they've done it in a stronger way, because they're actually debunking what these five Holocaust controversy guys have written. And therefore, they come at it in a little bit stronger manner, and I think it makes it more readable, more enjoyable, and it's even humorous. You know, it's even humorous. So, because they don't feel the need to treat these particular critics in the same respectful way that they did previous critics of theirs, so they're just telling it like it is. So it's pretty good. Now, I'm all right at this point. What I'm going to do is I'm going to part one and chapter one, both. Well, part one is written by Jürgen Graupp, and it contains the introduction, which he wrote, which is very interesting and easy to read, and nothing too difficult in there. And then the actual chapter one is titled The Insane Challenge, and it has several parts to it. This is all written by Jürgen Graupp. I'm going to read from that and comment on it as I do so. And then I'll just tell you that chapter two, I've got some quotes from there, was written by Carlo Mattonio. He also wrote chapter three. Jürgen Graupp wrote chapter four, and Carlo Mattonio wrote chapter five and six, and then a long chapter about where these Jews who were not exterminated in these Action Reinhardt camps, where they went, and all of that, which is some of this material has been it was written by Thomas Cuse, and some of it he has publicized already in shorter papers. But it's all here, and this is all some work that he's been very involved in. And then we go to part two, and I don't even have the table of contents for part two in front of me. But it's one thing I want to mention, that chapter 13, which is almost to the end of the book, you know, on page 1400, starts on page 1474, is in two parts. One is titled Asinine Judeo-Phantic Arrogance, as written by Carlo Mattonio. I just love that title of it, and I looked up Judeo-Phantic, and it's not a word, naturally. On the Jewish monitored internet, they wouldn't have such a word, but I figured out that it came from the word hierophant in Carlo Mattonio's mind. He has coined that word. Hierophant is defined as an official high priest of religious mysteries. And so these Judeo-Phantic are official high priests of Jewish religious mysteries, okay, particularly Jewish ones. And then the other half of conclusions was written by Jürgen Graupp, and he titled it The Bogeyman of Anti-Semitism. So these are sound really good, these two. I haven't read them yet, was just looking them over before the show. But I will probably do more shows on this, and I will get to that eventually. Now, what I'm going to do now is, and I don't, you know, I'll just tell you too, before I get started on this, I'm almost out of my, almost to my half hour point already, is that at Holocaust Controversies, of course, they've got a post on what these guys have written, and the one they posted today is Jürgen Graf keeps on giving, and they're making out that, you know, he's just given them a gift with all his stupidity and so on. This is how these guys talk. They're so arrogant, and with no basis for it. And they call these men, these writers, MGK. Everything is MGK's monster pamphlet, they call it. And that stands, of course, for Metonia Graf Cues. And they say that they've written something. The steaming pile of MGK manure is here. See, this is the way they talk, only much worse than that. This was the title of one of their latest posts. You know, just to let you know, I'm going to close off that page now. I'm done with that. So here I am at in chapter one of their book on Action Reinhardt camps, and it is chapter 1.3.3, and it's titled The Imaginary Enterfest Slaughter. Well, I shouldn't bother to read this because there's some others, the other parts I wanted to read might be more important, but I never heard of, it's Erntefest. I'm not pronouncing it right. I keep saying it wrong. Erntefest. The imaginary Erntefest slaughter. It comes after where they're writing about the alleged Babi Yar massacre. I think most of us have read plenty about Babi Yar. If you haven't, you can go find it. And it's a total fiction also, but this one is one I didn't know about. So I'm going to read it. On 24th July 1944, the Majdanek concentration camp near Lublin, Poland, was overrun by the advancing Red Army. Now, again, this is written by Jürgen Graf. 3 weeks later, a Polish-Soviet commission ascertained that no fewer than 1.5 million prisoners had been murdered in the camp. 44 in summer 1944. Subsequent research by Polish historians has since reduced this figure, however, first to 360,000 in 1948 and then to 235,000 in 1992. And all this is sourced, you know, in the footnotes. Then in 2005, Tomasz Grantz, head of the research department of the Majdanek Memorial Institution, caused a minor sensation by once more revising the number of victims downward, this time to 78,000. So it went from their original claim of 1.5 million, which lasted until after the Nuremberg trials, you know, and after all the decisions about the German monsters and so on, to now 78,000. Yet, as I have shown in an article first published in 2008, Kranz's figure is still too high by at least 28,000 deaths. Furthermore, in the book about Majdanek, which he co-authored with me and which first appeared in German in 1998, Carlo Metonio came to the conclusion that about 42,200 prisoners had perished at Majdanek, a figure which might actually be too low, though only by a few thousands. So the Orthodox historians, who had all the pertinent documents at their disposal from the beginning, had impudently and tenaciously lied for decades, while two deniers, meaning he and Metonio, they put deniers in quotes, they don't call themselves deniers, with limited resources, who had spent only several days in the Majdanek archives, came very close to the truth. It goes without saying that our five opponents would rather bite off their tongues than acknowledge this embarrassing fact. Kranz's startling revision seriously undermined the credibility of the official history of the camp, assuming that it was ever credible in the first place. Obviously, wanting to limit the damage, Kranz has tried to save the two central pillars of the extermination camp legend as regards Majdanek. The lie that there were, not going to use the word lie, the lie that there were homicidal gassings at the camp, And the lie that 17,000 Jews previously employed at armaments production sites were shot there on 3rd November 1943. Together with the alleged murder of 25,000 Jewish workers purportedly shot at two of Maidanek satellite camps, Poniatowa and Travniki, on the same day, this invented massacre has inexplicably found its way into Holocaust mythology under the name Action Erntefest, or Operation Harvest Festival. That's what Erntefest means, Harvest Festival. Predictably, Nicholas Terry, that's one of the five guys from Controversies guys, wholeheartedly endorses this story, meaning the entire story, just as it's told. So he says, Groff writes, a week before the alleged mass shooting, Oswald Pohl, chief of the SS Economic Administrative Main Office, that is what's called SSWVHA. When you see SSWVHA, that's the Economic Administrative Main Office of the SS. So that was the over the administrations of these camps. This Oswald Pohl had sent the commandants of all the concentration camps, including Majdanek, a directive. The text declared, in part, this is well known. I probably have read about this and just didn't recognize that name, Erntefest or something. Erntefest, but because I'm actually familiar with this, with a lot of this, but it's very, very easy to make out how they're mishandling the information, because what this SS administrator wrote to all the camps was, from nothing at all, we have created armaments productions sites that are unparalleled anywhere. We must now do everything to ensure that our achievements to date are not only maintained, but constantly increased, since the plants and factories are the vital aspects of this. This can only be achieved by maintaining and increasing the inmates' capacity to work. This directive shows how desperately the German military industry needed workers. So how can any sane person seriously believe that the SS killed 42,000 of them just 1 week later without any reason? Needless to say, there is not a shred of documentary or material evidence corroborating the claim that such a massacre occurred. As so often, the whole story is based exclusively on eyewitness reports. Ironically, official Polish historiography does not conceal the fact that sick prisoners were transferred to Majdanek from Auschwitz both before and after the alleged Erntefest slaughter. For example, in the entry for 3rd June 1943, in her Auschwitz Chronicle, Danuta Cech, who's considered one of the authorities amongst the Holocaust historians, notes 542 male and 302 female inmates from Majdanek were transferred from Auschwitz to the concentration camp Lublin Majdanek. According to the same source, on 25th November 1943, the registration was ordered of those inmates suffering from malaria who were quartered in the inmates' infirmary and the recovery blocks of Auschwitz. The malaria patients would be transferred to the Lublin camp, which is called Majdanek. So, you know, you've got people sent away from Auschwitz to Majdanek, and then you've got inmates from Majdanek transferred. No. Okay, same thing. From Auschwitz to Majdanek. And so I hope you're following this. Auschwitz, one must remember, is supposed to have been the greatest of all the extermination camps. Why then had the Auschwitz SS not killed these useless eaters on site by gassing or lethal injection, but instead decided to send them on to Majdanek, where they were not exterminated either? So here they are, people with malaria. That's what it started out with. Hey, these were victims of malaria. They were ill people, and they were transferred from Auschwitz to Majdanek. Why weren't they just, they had the gas chambers at Auschwitz. Why didn't they just exterminate these people, which is if that's what they were doing there? But no, they took these sick people and they had been workers, you know, but they only had malaria, and they sent them to Majdanek, and they weren't exterminated there. Now, between 12 December 1943 and March 1944, transports of six inmates continued to arrive in Majdanek from various other camps of the Reich. Again, nobody claims these people were exterminated there. Apparently, we got it all wrong. Far from killing sick Jews and sparing healthy ones, the SS spared the invalids and shot the able-bodied. A truly revolutionary insight, is it not, Dr. Terry? In the ninth chapter of our book about Majdanek, Carlo Mantonio quotes the confessions of a Erich Musfeld, former chief of the Majdanek crematorium, who described in Polish captivity how the Jews were shot in three ditches near the crematorium building. All right, this is an SS man who's was chief of the crematorium at Majdanek, supposedly, and he was in Polish captivity when he made this statement. He says he had said that the killing began at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning and ended around 5 p.m. So it could not have taken more than 11 hours. The Jews were liquidated in groups of 10. Assuming the executions took place in all three ditches simultaneously. Now let's see, this is, now Carlos saying that, let's see. Carlos is reporting what this man said, that it was 11 hours they had done all this executing, and in groups of 10, and Matonio says, assuming that all the executions took place were taking place in all three ditches simultaneously, it would indicate that there were 567 separate executions, but more people than that. Therefore, each execution took approximately 70 seconds. In this short time, the 10 people making up each of the three groups, now this would be 10 people in this 70 seconds, in order to get all these, you know, executions in that period of time. And this is the witness that they're using. They say this is the kind of witness testimony. They get it from a German man, from someone who was involved with the camp. And while they're, you know, they torture it out of them, and then they use it, but it doesn't even make any sense, as we see of so much of it. We have to look at all this. So it says, in the short time, in the 70 seconds, 10 people making up each of the three groups had to climb down into the ditch and lie down on the bodies of their predecessors to be shot in their turn. And this itself is what they said about Bobby Yar, too. It's just incredible that all these people calmly went down into this ditch and laid down on top of these already shot bodies, already dead bodies. Maybe some of them weren't quite dead yet, and laid there to be shot. If you're going to be shot like that, and they've got you lined up there, I mean, nobody would do that. They'd run away and get shot in the back or something than to go and do that. But this is what, you know, this guy said happened, and this is what they use in the so-called evidence for this event. And they have to come up with all this huge number of people killed, and so they take anything. And so they say that Carlos says after the first few executions, the victims would literally have had to climb onto the corpses of the earlier victims. And would this have been possible? Perhaps, he says now, perhaps, but only if all went absolutely smoothly. You know, nothing ever went wrong. What a pity that Musfeld did not tell his interrogators how long the SS and the Jews had practiced a procedure in order to get it just right. Of course, the whole story is nonsense. The Jews would have known that they had nothing left to lose and would have tried to escape or to set up resistance. Terry, who has read the book about our Majdanek, is fully aware of this fact. woefully unable to come. I'm not going to be taking any calls during this hour. Sorry. Woefully unable to counter Matonio's arguments, the British historian resorts, in effect, to changing the subject. Let me quick take a look over there and see. I don't know who this is, but it wouldn't be Bradley because he knows better than to not call until the right time, so I'm just ignoring it. So he says, this Nick Terry just tried to change the subject when this was brought up. And Jürgen Graf writes, I forgot, yeah, this is, some of the quotes are from Matonio, but it's Jürgen Graf who's written this chapter. I'm sorry. I was starting to say Matonio. Jürgen Graf writes, had Matonio and I written a book about Operation Erntefest, we would doubtless have studied the evidence for the parallel massacres as well, but our subject was Majdanek, and only one of the 10 chapters of our book dealt with Erntefest. Okay, the reason, this is important, the reason he put in this thing from Nick Terry is because Nick, in their criticism, in the book that they wrote, in their criticism of Matonio and Graf's books about these three camps, this Nick Terry wrote, Matonio's attempt at debunking the massacres in his 1998 brochure, it's a book, but they call it a brochure, on Majdanek is fairly feeble in its grasp of the available sources. Moreover, his total omission, ignorance, of the parallel massacres at Travniki and Poniatowa mean that we will simply send him back to the library and archives to deal with all the evidence rather than cherry pick it. Well, then Graf says, if they were writing about Erntefest, they would have gone into all that, but they were writing about Majdanek, and that had nothing to do with what they were writing about, he says. The very idea that the Germans would have killed large numbers of desperately needed munitions workers is risible from the outset, and as the evidence which the Holocaust historians cite for the alleged mass killing at Majdanek is frankly preposterous, neither Matonio nor I felt obliged to deal with Travniki and Poniatowa. And he says, the fact that the biggest mass shooting allegedly committed by the Germans in World War II belongs to the realm of fantasy, of course, does not mean that no shootings of Jews or non-Jews took place. No serious revisionist has ever made such an outlandish assertion, but it should give pause to a moderate revisionist like Samuel Crowell. Oh, this is one reason why I like this part. You know, I don't like Samuel Crowell, in spite of the fact that he goes after the gas chambers. That's a pseudonym, by the way, Samuel Crowell. But anyway, I'll finish what Graf wrote here. Should give pause to a moderate revisionist like Samuel Crowell, who in his interesting book, The Gas Chamber of Sherlock Holmes, rejects the gas chamber lie, but uncritically accepts the claim that Nazi Germany massacred, that is, shot millions of Jews. So, yeah, I really love Jürgen Graf. He never goes off base anywhere. I don't find. And so he's obviously not a fan of Samuel Crowell either, although Kodo website likes Samuel Crowell and has featured him quite a bit. And he's the author of this Gas Chamber of Sherlock Holmes, which is in a roundabout way tells this, you know, roundabout clever way, I guess, shows that that if you investigate, that's where the Sherlock Holmes comes in. If you investigate the gas chambers, you find that they don't hold up. So you have to do this investigating the way Sherlock Holmes would do. And Graf calls it an interesting book. I think that's a great choice of words. He doesn't call it anything more than that. And but he points out that Crowell is wrong to accept uncritically that millions of Jews were shot by the Germans, National Socialist Germans. And too many people who are considered revisionists are only halfway or partway revisionists, and they do accept that. They want to show that a whole lot of Jews were killed, and they have a right to have this big gripe, and it's like revising the Holocaust, you know, but not, saving enough of it that we can still have a Holocaust, see? And I've talked about this before. I won't talk about it anymore now, because now I can go on to chapter 1.4 in chapter 1, the role of Auschwitz and the Reinhardt camps in Orthodox and revisionist historiography. Well, I haven't gone through to find what the most important part of this is to read. And maybe I should go on to 1.5. Let's see, I went real fast. And just read 1.5 because I think it might be a little bit more interesting. Let's see, I think I just passed it up. Here, no. I have to go on a bit. I think I will do that though. 1.5, the alleged revisionist conspiracy theory. At the beginning of his chapter, the hoax that dare not speak its name, that's what he called his chapter, Nicholas Terry called it that, it's his chapter. He writes, from its inception, Holocaust revisionism has repeatedly asserted that we have been lied to about the fate of European Jewry at the hands of the Nazis. However much it might be denied by some contemporary negationists, Holocaust denial is unthinkable without some form of conspiracy theory. He says that this Nick Terry, who's of the five Holocaust controversies guys, I think he's the only one with a PhD. He has a PhD, whatever good it does for him, because we know a lot of PhDs just don't care, that they're very dishonest. Well, but he is saying that, he is making the statement, Holocaust denial, he uses denial instead of revisionism, is unthinkable without some form of conspiracy theory. Well, Jürgen Graf writes, with his usual dishonesty, Terry here presents a straw man version of the revisionist thesis. Of course, and I hope you all know what a straw man is, of course, nobody in possession of his mental faculties would seriously claim that the officially accepted Holocaust story is the product of a conspiracy in which the participants all agreed to suppress the truth and promote instead a falsified version of events agreed upon in advance. To refute Terry's nonsensical insinuation, I will shortly recapitulate how the legend really originated. Excuse me. It is a well-known aphorism that the first casualty of war is truth. In World War I, British atrocity mongers accused the Germans of cutting off the hands of Belgian children, crucifying enemy soldiers on church doors, and distilling glycerin from the bodies of their own dead soldiers. After the end of the war, this primitive propaganda against the Huns was discontinued. It was no longer needed. In 2002 and in early 2003, the Bush and Blair regimes in the U.S. and United Kingdom spread the lie that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction in order to justify their imminent war of aggression against a country which in reality could not possibly threaten them. A few months after the occupation of Iraq, Saddam's weapons of mass destruction were forgotten. In September 1939, the Germans conquered the western half of Poland, a country which was home to numerous large Jewish communities. In the summer of 1941, they overran the previously Soviet-occupied eastern half as well. Since the Germans had plenty of guns and the Jews had very few, the Jews were unable to resist the increasingly harsh measures imposed by the Germans. Ghettoization, confinement in concentration camps, conscription for labor, which made their lives miserable and indeed provoked the deaths of large numbers of them. Yeah, you know he has to say that much. In order to mobilize world opinion against the tormentors of their people, Jewish underground movements in Poland soon began spreading all kinds of mind-boggling stories about the extermination of their co-religionists, whom the Germans allegedly were murdering by electricity, steam, gas, and other exotic means. The Holocaust controversies bloggers make a futile attempt to explain away these embarrassing contemporary reports about electrocution facilities and steam chambers and the like as simple inaccuracies, wartime hearsay, and Chinese whispers. But this explanation does not hold water for a minute. In order to make mincemeat of this theory, to use Sergei Romanov's charming formulation, it suffices to recall the lengthy report about the steam chambers of Treblinka published by the resistance movement of the Warsaw Ghetto on 15th November 1942. I will quote merely an excerpt. Well, you know, it's just this crazy story. I just, you know, maybe I should read it because... But, you know, it's that they beat these people. They sent women and children and men all on, you know, into these rooms, and they had these electric floors, and they were slipping around, and then they were throwing the children over the heads of the ones who were the adults who were already in there, and nobody could get up. And then when they got it all filled up, they closed the doors, hermetically sealed them, and the people slowly suffocated. But then they, this is a steam chamber. Then they brought out the steam and through the vents of the pipes, you know, and then that's the way they killed them all by this steam. So according to another passage in the report, 2 million, and he has an exclamation mark there. That's a huge number. 2 million Jews had already been killed in the steam chambers of Treblinka. And the Germans were preparing to exterminate the entire Polish population as well in those very same chambers. So these were early reports of the kind of thing that was being sent out. Propaganda, I mean, false propaganda that was being sent out, atrocity propaganda, to the West, to the Allied governments and so on, try to get them to believe it. In 1944, a Geneva-based rabbi, Adolf Abraham Silberschein, published another lengthy report about Treblinka. And this is really crazy, too, but I'm not going to read it all. It's just full of nonsense, absolute nonsense. And this was put out in 1944. And so Graf writes, by claiming that the authors of such ridiculous reports, which Matonio and I extensively quote in the book Treblinka, were acting in good faith, and merely committed an excusable error by relying on wartime hearsay, our opponents once again make fools of themselves. As a matter of fact, such reports were classic examples of coarse atrocity propaganda. They were obvious hoaxes, and I'm going to skip a little more again because we know all this. Starting in December 1941, the reports concocted by various Jewish underground movements were forwarded to Jewish organizations all over the world. The fact, however, that the press and the Allied nations did not give a repeated front-page coverage of the allegedly ongoing mass slaughter, if at all, indicates to what extent the Jewish leaders in these nations believed these grotesque tales. So even the Jews didn't believe them. They knew that this was going too far, it was too much. And but after the war, he writes, the victors decided to maintain and even extend their wartime extermination propaganda, because unlike the horror stories of World War I and the lies about Iraqi weapons, they were still very useful to the interested party. Well, I'm glad I got to this. This is important. There's three in the interested parties that Jürgen Graf identifies here are, one, the Zionist Jews with influence in international media and political circles. They naturally understood that the Holocaust tale would give them the status of a martyr nation, a victim of a crime unprecedented in magnitude, and so forth. And he goes in to describe the creation of Israel and so on. The second group, he says, despite the animosity which has always characterized Polish-Jewish relations, the Poles also stood to benefit from the Holocaust hoax. After all, Poland had annexed huge tracts of German territory at the end of the war and brutally expelled the overwhelming majority of their ethnic German population. In order to justify this crime against humanity, the Poles thus needed an ever more heinous German crime to point to, and the Holocaust was it. So they are very much involved in keeping the Holocaust alive. And the third one, and for the Western Allies and the Soviet Union, the Jewish extermination tale was of great utility as well, for it enabled them to hush up their own crimes, such as the indiscriminate firebombing of German cities and the Katyn massacre, which they were able to continue blaming on Germans for a long time after the war. So thanks to the Holocaust, Stalin was able to take on the role of a savior who had freed half of Europe instead of a brutal man who had put half of Europe under tyranny. And the victorious powers could use the Holocaust to prevent any resurgence of German nationalism, which they are very interested in doing, as we know. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's all I got.
Erinnert an deine Qual, keiner kommt mehr hierher, niemand vermisst dich mehr. Oh, es tut weh, wenn ich deinen Stein so sehe, treuer Soldat, mehr als ein namenloses Grab. Ich höre Stimmen, ich höre Gespräch, du Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben, nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten, für kein Geld der Welt. Ich kämpfe für dich. Ungebrochener Held, ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich höre das zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer da noch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld hier beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand. Ein Totenwächter von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter. Ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Es ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Ihr habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht. Für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen. Ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich sag zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein.
Ich höre eine Stimme,
zu mir spricht, du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
All right. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. The topic is the Holocaust hoax. And that music that you just heard was Unknown Soldier by Annette Mueller. In German, it's Unbekannter Soldat. And if you want to know more about Annette Mueller or learn the words to the song in English, which is not as good as, you know, in English, they're just translated straight out. They don't rhyme or they don't, you know, have the same feeling to them, but, or know how to go to her web, how to go to, this on the YouTube. You go to, the page for this program, Saturday Afternoon for Carolyn, go to the program page. And you'll find all that information there. Now we're going to see if Bradley Smith calls in. I'm all set up here to take his call. If he does, I want to go over one more time what I was ending up with there is that that Jürgen Groff says that the Holocaust was the creation of three groups of people who had an interest in it, and the main, you know, basically. And he lists them. And I don't know if the order that they're in is important. Doesn't say, but might be. First, he says, is the Jews. Second is the Poles. And third is the Allies, the Anglo-Americans, and including the Soviet Union, to cover up their crimes and to keep what you might call the benefits that they gained from winning the war and from let's say what they gained at Nuremberg during all the tribunals and so on. And he sees that as wanting to stop any upsurge in German nationalism. And according to what I was saying at the beginning of the program, they don't want any nationalism anywhere. And they use the demonization of German nationalism in the lie that it ended up in genocide and Holocaust for all kinds of people, and not just Jews. Now they like to go into, well, I had something good there from, it might be here from, I might have it on this page. From, let me just, since we don't have a call yet from Bradley, and I'll be able to continue with some of this if he doesn't call in. I don't know You know, last time he was on, he forgot until about a half hour, you know, I don't know, 15 minutes into it or so, and then he called. So I don't know. I sent him that email. I'm not going to go hunting around in my email. The email that I look at right now for the program is not the same email that I wrote to him on. So anyway, we'll see. Under Chapter 2, which was written, as I said, by Carlo Mantogno, in under 2.4, the chapter section, which is called Scope and Significance of Our Response. I wrote this down because I stuck this in here because I thought it was so good. So let's see what it says. Our response, he was defining what their response aims to do. And he says, our response thus aims, above all, to show the total vacuity of Orthodox Holocaust historiography's claim that Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka were extermination camps equipped with homicidal gas chambers. In this sense, the plagiarist bloggers, he calls them, have made a decisive contribution. On the one hand, rendering obvious the total historical inconsistency of such a claim, while on the other, stimulating us to extremely profitable new discoveries. This latter point relates in particular to the... There he is. Okay. He's calling. He's not even really late, so maybe... let me... answer this. I can remember how. 29069. Well, I hope it's him and not somebody else. Let's see. There's a number. Hello, who's on the line?
Hi, Carolyn. My name is Joel, and I am calling from Illinois.
Well, Joel, all right. What are you calling about?
Okay, I want to add two addenda to your comments about the Holocaust. I think you're doing a wonderful job as a scholar in proving the Holocaust never took place. But here's what I think you're missing. I think you should speak to the motive of the Jews for pretending there was a Holocaust. Now, let me give you,
Hey, Joel, hold on. I have done this many times, and so have others, so it's not like it's something that's really missing. What I'm trying to focus on today is the book by these three gentlemen, and get people to read the book and so on. So if you have something you want to say, I think I've heard from you before. You sound real familiar. And I don't want to be rude, but I don't want you to go on in a long... are you sure your name is Joel? Okay.
Yeah. I
don't want you to go on very long. If you go too long, I'm gonna cut you off. Okay.
Okay.
So if you have something real brief.
Okay. My comments are about reparations. First of all, the Jews have blackmailed the German people out of more than 100 billion.
Yeah, Joel. You know, there's nothing new about this. We know this. Everybody knows this. Probably everybody who's listening to this program knows this. Now.
All right, if that's old news, I've got some newer news. Can I try the newer news pretty please?
All right.
All right, let me tell you the new news. In 2007, Jews in our Congress and our Senate began a criminal conspiracy called the Holocaust Accountability Act of 2007. What the Jews in the Congress and the Senate are doing is they are going now to all of our insurance companies here in the United States, and they're demanding to see insurance company records dating back to 1935 to 1940. And these Jews are alleging that every Jew in Northern Europe in that period from 35 to 45 had a dowry insurance policy with an insurance company in the United States. This is a completely fabricated story. It's a lie. But the Jews are about to sue the United States people, mom and dad, through our insurance companies for $200 billion in reparations for dowry insurance policies that they never had.
Yeah, but I don't think they're going to get anywhere with it, you see. And some of these things that the Jews are trying to do, somebody in Congress is supporting it or sponsoring it or something, you know, some people. But they don't get voted. They don't even get up for a vote. So I'm not sure. I think I've heard something about this, but I'm not too sure how much of a danger it is. But, you know, you're right. They're always doing stuff like this. They're always doing it. They can't stop trying to make money off of this. And it may not be always the main players, the largest international Jewish top people who are trying to do this kind of thing. But it's other Jews who are not without resources who come up with these schemes to use the Holocaust to come up with some, you know, like I said, a scheme to make money. And this is another thing that is wrong with this Holocaust continuing to be a viable thing, because it just opens up all these possibilities that you've just brought up.
Okay, well, another thing, there's a lady named Lasha Darkmoon.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right, I'm not going to talk about Lasha Darkmoon. She's okay, she does her thing, but she doesn't have anything to tell us, anything new. And so I want to thank you for your call, Joel, and I want to continue on with talking about this book, okay?
Oh, well, thank you for letting me speak for a minute or two. Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, goodbye. Well, he was nice, you know, but I don't want to. They want to go off into something that I'm not about to do a show on. So if I'm not about to do a show on it, I don't want them to come on and do their own show on it. All right. So I was reading this. I don't know if Bradley's going to call or not. I was reading this, and I had gotten as far as, okay, Latonia writes, in this sense, the plagiarist bloggers have made a decisive contribution. On the one hand, rendering obvious the total historical inconsistency of such a claim, while on the other, stimulating us to extremely profitable new discoveries. This latter point relates in particular to the introduction of a conspicuous mass of new documents brought together in our presentation of many new arguments still more solid than those published by ourselves in the past. The result is the end of the legend of the Action Reinhardt extermination camps. Boy, did I like that. And do I like to hear Carlo Mantegna speak so plainly. Well, Carlo Mantegna has always been very good and speaks, you know, concludes things very plainly. But sometimes his books are so filled with all this detail of, depending on what he's writing about, but of gas chamber information or this type or that type and what supplies were ordered and all these lists and so on, that, you get kind of, if you get a little discouraged and you don't find some of the better parts. I like the summing up. I like the summing up things because I don't need to be convinced. I don't need to look at all this evidence that they bring forth, as he says. These documents, they've got all kinds of new documents that they've pulled together for. And a lot of these are in the part two, although there's footnotes, as I said, throughout. So, you know, backing up what they're saying. But a lot of these, a lot of this stuff, I think, is in part two. And I'm sticking with part one for a while because there's a lot there. And I think this is just great. He is saying that they have got a lot of new material that they've added in this book that they didn't have in their previous books. And, you know, they had, as I said, they had a book for Blinka, they have a book for Belzec, and they have a book for Sobibor. And they had a book on Majdanek, you know, all separately. But here he says they've got new stuff and more stuff and better arguments because of it. And he then says that it's the end of the legend of the Action Reinhardt extermination camps. Well, they've already come to the end of the legend of the Auschwitz extermination camp and the Auschwitz gas chambers. And they're going on, you know, to the Action Reinhardt, as so-called Action Reinhardt, to these three camps in at the far edge of Poland. right before you go out of the general government into Russian territory, which at the time, for a time, was controlled by Germans too, when they captured all that land, but then later they were pushed back again. And so anyway, but that is the boundary between Poland and some of these Russian-held territories that are not actually Russian. They're not actually, they were Soviet, but now they're not actually Russian anymore. They have some kind of independent ones, Byelorussia, Lithuania, so on, Ukraine. But that's why they were there. They were there before they went across into that outside of the actual German claimed area, you know, what they considered their own state. So this is very strong language, and this is the kind of thing you should be looking for in here. Now, what I was, if anybody wants to call with a, you know, some good comments or question about what's been talked about so far, you're welcome to do so. What I was going to talk to Bradley about, and I don't want to disappoint people who might want to hear about that, was some of the projects he's got going, and I especially wanted to talk about Jan Karski. Now, Bradley told me that he did not know, he was not able to talk about Jan Karski, and Jet Rucker can't come on the show either. We asked him if he would, but come on with Bradley, but he wouldn't. But Bradley sponsors these things, and I should have gone to, I can still do it, no, I should have gone to his blog, Bradley's blog, to see directly. I might have to do that later. But right now, I can just talk about that in Bradley's, Smith's report, the latest one for October that just came out. On the front of it is an article by Jet Rucker on Jan Karski. And I've been very interested in this man. He's a Polish supposed hero, Holocaust hero. He wasn't a survivor. He wasn't a inmate. He was supposedly a courier, underground courier, and worked in the resistance and so on. But he is, Jet Rucker points out, calls him a lot of not very nice things, like, you know, a liar, a base opportunist, and so on, who has put things over on people. So I wanna go through some of that. First, I'll say a little bit about him, because in this book by Matonio Graf and Cues, Matonio writes somewhat about Jan Karski in one part of it, and this is some of what I took from there. He says, in this context, our critics mention the Polish underground courier Jan Karski, who's and as Jet Rucker points out, let's see, his real name was where is it? Good grief, Kozielewski. Probably pronounced Kozielewski. But when he was working in the resistance, he changed it to Karski, and that's what it has remained ever since. And I don't know which one I should read first, actually, but I said I was going to read what Matonio said, so I will. He said that Karski engaged in black propaganda among German soldiers, and that, in fact, that there's some book on him that, in fact, is an excellent example for establishing the real significance of black propaganda. Karski is introduced as follows on page 15 of this book. A further crucial report combining information compiled by Oneg Chavez with Polish underground sources was brought out by the Polish underground courier Jan Karski in November 1942. Then he says that the plagiarist bloggers, meaning these Holocaust controversies, five some, however, are careful to avoid mentioning the actual content of this crucial report. In it, Karski, in fact, claims to have infiltrated the Belzec camp, but found no gassing installation there. Yeah, he's, you know, what's interesting here is that he's pointing out that there's this report by Jan Karski, but he says that when the plagiarist bloggers, which means the, you know, Nick Terry and Muhlenkamp and that crowd, bring it up and talk about it and use that information for their own purposes, they don't mention the content of the report because it's so crazy. It's more of this crazy stuff. And it came directly from this Jan Karski, who is known today as a great man, a great hero, a great scholar, a great person. And he had a long career at Georgetown University, and now they created one of these Holocaust institutes there at Georgetown with his name on it, and where Holocaust study can go on, and you know what you find almost every university, even little ones, but mostly the big ones, have these Holocaust institutes in one way or another in there, you know, as a big part of the curriculum. That you, it's not always a big part of the curriculum, but it's there, and people can go and take courses there and study there and so on. And they use it for a lot of publicity and so on. So he says that in this report, Martonio writes, Karski, in fact, claims to have infiltrated the Belzec camp, but found no gassing installation there. And that's the truth. He never mentioned anything about a gas chamber. But now they say that there were gas chambers there, and that's about all there was there. Some undressing rooms, you know, and a place to burn bodies, because there were no... Now, in these three camps, just to remind you, there were no... Nobody claims that they had cremation facilities. They built these rough kind of gas chambers, which they didn't have enough to begin with. I mean, I'm trying to remember which one we start with. We start maybe with Belzec, but they had three or four little small rooms for gas chambers. And that's another thing that's brought out by our authors, that the Germans wouldn't build a gas chamber in with four separate little small sections in it, where, you know, separated by walls and so on. So you could only get so many into each room at a time. And you had to, you know, put in the gas and heat up the Zyklon and so on, or if they were using engine exhaust, you had to put all that into these separate rooms, and then go out in and pull out these dead Jews separately, you know, and would have much less space. But it just was not efficient at all. And then when they realized that they couldn't kill enough Jews at one time, They built more rooms. They did it the same way. They kept adding small little rooms until there was four, and then eight, and then in one place 16 or something like that, or 12. And it just didn't make any sense whatsoever. But he says that these, Karski didn't see anything like that when he was there in his original report. He saw, he said, this is his story. And it took me a while to get it straight, because when I first used to read about it, it didn't make sense. I think it's because they were trying not to really tell it the way it was. And so, you know, it was confusing. But what it was that, Matonio can write about it real clearly, that Karski says there were death trains. And at this camp, at Belzec, they loaded up these trains with victims, mostly Jews. They always said they were mostly Jews at these three camps. They loaded them up, and they sprinkled quicklime inside, or they sprinkled the quicklime already into these rail cars and then put the Jews in there. and closed them all up. And then he says he saw them drive to a location 80 miles away. Now, what did he do? Follow it 80 miles away? I'm not clear about that. But at this location, 80 miles away from the camp, they just parked the train and let it sit for a few days, and the victims all until they were all dead inside. Now, why would you ever go about such a long, time-consuming process as that? I don't know. And see, none of these stories they came up with, even supposedly this intelligent man who later became a professor at Georgetown University, these stories are just incredible. And Matonya says, I have described Karski's various eyewitness testimonies in the section from electrocution to the death to the train of death in my book on Belzec, which I did not ever read. This story, from the Orthodox Holocaust point of view, is obviously untrue. From the revisionist point of view, it could be a distortion of reports of transports which actually left the camp for other destinations. But in any case, this explains the embarrassing silence or the embarrassed silence of our critics, who clearly know full well that black propaganda consists precisely of intentional lies. Intentional lies. Not mistakes. Not things that they heard wrong. Not things that they heard about and, you know, were repeated or whatever. No, intentional lies. That's black propaganda. And Matonya says that this black propaganda starts with the propaganda spread by Karski himself. This is a very bad accusation against this man who's supposed to be so great. And this program I'm going to talk about in a minute that Bradley Smith and Chet Rucker and we're working on against Karski and his reputation at Georgetown came out before this book was out, although they may have had some early reading of it. But, I mean, it doesn't necessarily come from what Matonya wrote in the book, because this stuff has been known before this. And now Matonya goes on to say, to get into the UN declarations about German atrocities against Jews, which was in process, while the war was still going on. And he writes, a UN declaration concluded with the threat that the United Nations reaffirm their solemn resolution to ensure that those responsible for the crimes shall not escape retribution and to press on with the necessary practical measures to this end. So whatever the UN put out at that time, they concluded with this. And it's kind of funny because we know that those responsible for the great crimes of World War II were the Allies. And it says there that those who are responsible shall not escape retribution. Of course, just the opposite happened. These criminals escaped any retribution. And all the retribution was intended to be enacted on the Germans for reasons I've given and others have given many times. The draft of this declaration had been discussed at the Foreign Office in London by the beginning of December. I think this is, I'm not sure. This is 42, I think, but maybe I'm totally wrong about that. Sorry about that. By the beginning of December, following the arrival of a great many propaganda reports, the last of which was one by none other than Jan Karski, dated November 25th. I think it is 42. A note dated 26th November summarizes the discussion at that point. So this was a discussion going on at the Foreign Office in London about how this declaration should be drafted. You know, it hadn't been made yet. And they, of course, naturally, London Foreign Office had a whole lot of input on this, and they were deciding what they thought it should be. And during this discussion, there was a note as a part of it, you know, going through the archives, that many of which are available now. Matonya found this. This is some of what he found. that there was something titled Extermination of Jews in Europe. And it said, Mr. Law, it was like records of their discussion, Mr. Law records a conversation with Mr. Silverman and Mr. Easterman regarding the extermination of Jews in Europe. Mr. Silverman pressed that His Majesty's government should take some action to relieve these atrocities and suggested that a four-power declaration be made by the United Nations declaring that the perpetrators would be duly punished and also that use should be made of broadcasting to encourage non-Jews to aid the Jews under persecution. Well, this is nothing real surprising here, but it does show that it was Jews who were involved in these discussions, and they were the ones who were pushing for a declaration, and that was, you know, that the perpetrators, meaning the Germans, taking these atrocity rumors and reports seriously and saying that, you know, we're going to punish these people who are doing this and broadcasting this to encourage non-Jews to aid the Jews under persecution. This is really good, isn't it? In a handwritten note, this is Carlos again, writing, in a handwritten note dated 27th November, Dennis Allen, an official from the ministry's central department, advised that the upcoming UN declaration should, quote, in the absence of clearer evidence, avoid too specific reference to the plan of extermination, unquote, and restrict itself to condemning the, quote, German policy, unquote, with regards to the Jews. So there was someone who was saying, we better be a little careful about this because we don't really have evidence. Now here in this, that's what's said in another Foreign Office official, Frank Roberts, noted in the same vein, and this is part of the records that they have from the Foreign Office, a statement on the above lines, meaning the declaration, would have to be somewhat vague, or the above lines is, you know, the accusation that that these atrocities were being committed by the Germans, would have to be somewhat, a statement about it would have to be somewhat vague, since we have no actual proof of these atrocities. Right there he says, we have no actual proof of these atrocities, although I think that their probability is sufficiently great to justify action on the above lines, if this is considered essential with a view to satisfying parliamentary opinion here. That is, it sounds like Parliament, enough members of Parliament were kind of, calling for something to be done about these reports that the Jews were being persecuted and were being exterminated and were being, you know, all these things were being done to them and they're being gassed and so on. So something, we needed to do something, we need to say something, speak out. So there was some effort in Parliament there, you know, no doubt led by you know who. And the so it goes on, this report from Frank Roberts says the propagandists could then take statements on the above lines as their cue. Without such statement, it would, I think, be dangerous to embark upon a propaganda campaign lacking a foundation of quotable and proved facts. So on the 2nd of December of that same year, whatever year it was, a Foreign Office note composed by Anthony Eden relates to a conversation between himself and Soviet Ambassador Ivan Maisky on the upcoming UN declaration. So they're still working on this, what's going to go into this UN declaration, which there was eventually one. After expressing warm approval for the speech that he had just made in the House of Commons, that is Anthony Eden, intimating that Stalin would feel the same as he did, Maisky, the Soviet ambassador, was intimating that to Eden that Stalin would feel the same way he did. He said, His Excellency, the Foreign Office note said, His Excellency, the ambassador, went on to say that I had referred to the position of the Jews in Europe and to the systematic attempt which appeared to be being made now by the Germans to exterminate them. The Jews had been to see him as they had been, he understood, to see me, and they had been to see Eden and also this Soviet ambassador in the matter, and their suggestion, the Jews' suggestion, as he understood it, was that the three powers, ourselves, the United States, and Russia, should join in a condemnation of these atrocities and state that those who perpetrated them would be punished when the day of retribution came. The day of retribution. Yeah. The admission as to who lobbied for the declaration, this is Matonio now, the admission as to who lobbied for the declaration on both sides is certainly revealing, meaning the Jews. The note closes with Eden describing on his own, that is not relating Ambassador Maisky's words, the Great Powers Declaration as, quote, the statement for which the Jews were asking. Uh-huh. That comes directly from Eden. The document establishing the future Allied military tribunals was not, therefore, based on any actual proof, but rather on a mere probability of German atrocities. But the United Nations had now committed themselves before the entire world in such a manner that their courts had to prove German crimes in some way. Well, you see what he's saying? He's saying that they committed themselves to believing that they knew more about these German atrocities than they did know, and that they had already, you know, tried and convicted the Germans in their United Nations declaration. And now, in order to justify themselves, that's not the right word for that, but then we see this all the time. We see how they go all out, they go too far, and then we see this with Obama in a lot of things in his administration. Then they have to go along and do things because they don't want to look stupid. They don't want to look wrong. They put out this big declaration. So now, you know, when the Nuremberg came along, they had to prove these crimes, and everybody cooperated in doing so to save face. I guess that's the word I wanted to use, to save face. Now, in Bradley Smith's Smith's report for October, and as I said, the leading story was by Jet Rucker on Jan Karski, and I've got some quotes here from it I'm going to go through. Jet wrote, "The man whose image is cast in immortal bronze on the bench." Oh, yes. At Georgetown University, I think it is, there's a bronze bench with the bronze figure of Jan Karski sitting on it. And he's over on one side so that other people could actually sit on the bench, you know, with him. And so Rucker says, "The man whose image is cast in immortal bronze on the bench in capitals all around the world between Washington and Warsaw, was a base opportunist who exploited the very real suffering." Maybe they put this bronze thing in other places. I don't know. I missed that. Maybe that, you know, bronze, you can cast a lot of bronze images. Maybe other people are using it too. In any case, Rucker says that Karski, exploited the very real suffering of Europe's Jews during World War II to serve the interests of his first employer, the Foreign Ministry of the Government of Poland, that in September 1939 evaporated. So Jet Rucker goes more after the Poles than he is after the Jews. Of course, he is, he has strong, you know, close relations with Jews. And so, but he doesn't really spare the Jews too much, but here he's going after the Poles. He says, "Once the ship of the Polish state started sinking after World War II, this resourceful rat, Karski, jumped to the safer decks of the United States, in whose language He acquired very useful tutelage during service in Poland's mission to Britain before the war. After Israel's 1967 war against its Arab neighbors and the need to cover up who started it and why and what its consequences were, it was at this time that the Jan Karski Institute for Holocaust Education took up residence in the hallowed halls of Georgetown University near the banks of the Potomac. Yeah, it's in Washington, or around Washington, or in Maryland, or something. His numerous, speaking of Karski's, numerous and egregious exaggerations of his roles as a lieutenant in the Polish army, a junior diplomat in the Polish foreign ministry, a courier turned public relations agent for the London-based Polish government in exile, a best-selling author, a university professor, and finally a saint. Well, he's just going through in this. I'm just picking things out here, but he's going through saying the kind of the career that this Karski went through. He started out just as a lieutenant in the Polish army, and he's ended up a saint all around the world, like Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel, the Hungarian, and Jan Karski, the Polish person. It may have begun, Rucker goes on, it may have begun in London in 1937 when Kozłowski was a very junior diplomat in Poland's embassy, where the ambassador, Edward Rosinski, was privy to secret communications among Poland, Britain, France, and the United States, in which the American president was assuring, that is Roosevelt, was assuring the Europeans that the industrial and military might of his country was behind them in any moves they might make to oppose German initiatives on the continent. To Poland, of course, this provided a free hand in dealing with troubles arising from oppression of German minorities trapped in Polish territories by the Treaty of Versailles, a freedom they exploited vigorously. Our saint, Saint Karski, may well have been privy to all these machinations. Be that as it may, Kozłowski was returned to Warsaw by February of 1938. Skipped ahead here. Oh no, there it is. Kozłowski was returned to Warsaw in February 1938. See, we're going back again now. He was a lieutenant in the army. He got this position in the London government in exile of Poland. What was he doing there? He was a diplomat. Okay, he was in the diplomatic. He was a junior diplomat in Poland's embassy. But then he was returned to Warsaw in 1938 because of, you know, what was going on there. This is pre-war, of course, where he could well have been privy to the part taken by Poland's foreign ministry in the escalation of tensions with Germany I rewrote some of this, so to simplify it, but I might have left something out. Tensions with Germany were instigated ultimately by... Oh, I see what it means. Sorry about that. Poland's foreign ministry in the escalation of tensions with Germany... instigated ultimately by the renegade president of the giant in North America, Franklin D. Roosevelt, okay, saying that he may have known about some of the things that were being done between, that were being said between the Poland's foreign ministry and those serving Franklin Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt himself. This is partly in the Pataki papers, you know, so... But Rucker says, our man, Karski, was still a lieutenant in the horse artillery of the Polish Army Reserves. And he had to, even though reluctantly, had to heed the mobilization order of August 23rd, 1939. And, you know, he's reminding us that there was a Polish mobilization order mobilizing against Germany on August 23rd, 1939. That's long before September 1st, isn't it? Like a week. That's a week ahead. that preceded the, quote, surprise, unquote, attack from Germany a bit over a week later. On that infamous September 1st, where of 1939, where was Lieutenant Kozlowski? With his horse artillery unit in the Polish army barracks at Auschwitz. He thinks that's quite amazing. When the first explosions occurred, the unit's horses reportedly ran away. So the entire unit, Kozlowski himself says, turned and ran without firing a single shot in resistance. The story says a lot about the Wehrmacht, how the Wehrmacht found Poland's opposition such a joke. Well, that's Rucker's statement. You know, I should tell you, he's pretty, he's not giving the Poles a break here. He doesn't think much of how they were behaving. So he writes, his counterattack of subterfuge began with misrepresenting his rank to his Soviet captors, who, accepting his claims of being a mere enlisted man so that he wouldn't, you know, he was an officer, but he told them he wasn't. And I guess got rid of his insignia or something. And he was released before they took 15,000 of his fellow officers to Katyn and shooting them. Rucker seems to think he would have been among those. I read that somewhere else, that he saved himself from Soviet captivity and would have been one of those who was shot at Katyn by lying to the Soviets about his rank. And this is just, as many people have said, just typical of him. He figured out there how much lying could help him. Rucker says he surely realized then that deceit could save his life, but it could do more, much more. And I think what he means is it could also make him rich, because he ended up a rich and famous man. Where am I here? His wartime wanderings thereafter took him to many places rarely visited by Catholic Poles, including the Warsaw Ghetto, where he witnessed atrocities witnessed by no one else, and reportedly the concentration camp at Belzec, except that he later admitted his penetration of Belzec actually occurred at a transit camp some kilometers distant from Belzec, where he made reports of goings-on seen by no one else. Now, this is interesting. You know, he's just pointing out that he did get into the Warsaw Ghetto, and as a Catholic Pole, he thought it had to be difficult to do that. And there's question whether he was a really Jewish and had been brought up, you know, his family had switched and become Catholic, and he's brought up Catholic, whatever. But I don't go into that because I have no idea. But anyway, there weren't too many Catholics in the Warsaw Ghetto, but he was in there as some kind of a, you know, secret agent to find out what was going on and report it. And he did make a courier trip to London after he came out of there. But Rucker is saying that he witnessed things witnessed by no one else, because the things that he reported were things that, you know, could not be verified, and nobody else said them. And then this whole story about Belzec, which I went into when Matonio was talking about it, with the trains with the quicklime in them, and they put these people in the trains and drove them out of the camp and just let them die in the trains. This is also reports that nobody else saw, and nobody else reported it, anything like that. So later, Karski was touring the United States, and which Rucker says, to which his country, meaning Poland, had long since delivered the war desired by its president, meaning Roosevelt. And Rucker says he, like the real Forrest Gump, gained an audience with the very same President Roosevelt, who presumably thanked Kozlowski for his assistance in the former's diabolical plot. After the fact, we hear that Kozlowski treated Roosevelt to hair-raising stories of cruelty by the Germans to people of the religion of Roosevelt's Secretary of State, Henry Morgenthau, Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, Bernard Baruch, and many other key supporters. Very funny. Okay. Well, it's funny if you're not Polish, I guess. If you're Polish, you might take offense at that. But this Karski, some time back, Bradley Smith sent out one of his mailers with a letter to Georgetown University about they were having a dinner honoring Jan Karski, and also I think announcing, or in any event, honoring also this Holocaust institute that had been created at Georgetown University called the Jan Karski, Institute for Holocaust Studies or something. And it was a big deal. And so Bradley, as he likes to write to colleges and universities and their presidents and head people and so on, and make statements about things. He and Jet Rucker were going to do a campaign on this. But then when I asked about what was happening with it, he said they decided they couldn't do it. I don't know what it was. I don't know. But they didn't go any further with it. But now Jet has written this article and put it on Smith's report. Jet helps Bradley out a lot with his particular endeavors that Bradley does on his own. They're not a part of Kodo, although he uses the Kodo name, of course. But there's kind of Bradley's got his own thing going there. And then they have another article on the HETI, which is the Holocaust Educational Trust Ireland. And I found this interesting too, because I have written about the Holocaust Education Trust in Britain quite a bit, and it's in the news all the time, especially now, pushing, raising money to send more and more young people, students from Europe and the United Kingdom and so on, to these camps in Poland and teach them about the Holocaust and teach them in the classrooms about the Holocaust. And they're all big in this. Well, now there's one that's been formed in Ireland. And this person, let's see, how's this work? The attempt by the Nazis to exterminate the Jews of Europe and to annihilate other groups because of their nationality, ethnicity, desire, disability, sexual orientation, religious or political beliefs was not an accident of history. So says this group. They say it was a conscious policy, carefully planned and administered by an educated elite, with the active cooperation of tens of thousands and the complicity of millions. Now, we know the book by Matonio, Graf, and Kues, and their other books and works tell us that this is not so. And we know that the truth that can be proven is that there was no plan. It was not a conscious policy. There was a conscious policy to get the Jews out of the country, but there was no conscious policy to exterminate them or annihilate these other groups, except to suppress certain, homosexual people. And I don't know. When they say religious, they're usually referring to Jehovah's Witnesses, who are known to be not loyal to any nation on earth, where they live. And this was a necessity in National Socialist Germany. If you were a citizen, if you're living, you had to be loyal to Germany. That's an intelligent idea that they had. And so, all these people were somewhat persecuted because they weren't following along with what was expected. But then there's this thing that they're pushing now, that there was the active cooperation of tens of thousands and the complicity of millions. I mean, this is, again, they want to demonstrate that all of Germany is forever under this cloud of being a country of murderers. And he says, we believe that much of that history that we are taught today, this is Bradley Smith saying this. So Bradley Smith writes this letter to the HETI, Ireland, and he's telling them that, that they would like to come to their conference. Some revisionists, they're having a conference, and revisionists would like to come, but they've been called anti-Semites and deniers, and they weren't allowed to. Didn't invite them and wouldn't allow them to come. And Bradley says, this is actually signed by, I think, this person named Merlin. I don't have any more than this here. I don't have that. But I think it was signed by this David Merlin, who uses Bradley's address and phone number and everything. I'm not sure who he is, if he is somebody other than Bradley. But he always writes very respectfully. And he says that we believe that much of that history that we are taught today has been influenced by Soviet, British, and American wartime propaganda, which exaggerated and exploited real tragedies for propaganda purposes. Now, I notice he doesn't mention Jews there. And he says this concerns not just Jews, but Slavs, Roma, Jehovah's Witnesses, and in some versions, gays. It can be argued that there is considerable research that supports this point of view. So what this letter from Bradley and Merlin are saying, which is one thing that bothers me, and I wasn't going to bring it up if Bradley was on, or I thought I might bring it up, but is that they still don't want to go after the Jews very much. They want to go after Soviet, British, and American wartime propaganda, which is good to do. It's true. But then they say that the victims were the Jews, but also Slavs, Roma, Jehovah's Witnesses, and gays. And I cannot go along with all of that, with this sympathy for all these groups. It's way too left-wing for me. And then he goes on to end up by saying the enemies of tolerance and diversity are not always the same, nor are their targets. Surely, however, one certain sign of bigotry expresses itself in the unwillingness to allow others to speak or even listen to the other. Well, I also don't like using tolerance, standing up for tolerance and diversity and attacking bigotry in the name of Holocaust freedom, freedom to talk about it. But we have now got 60 seconds, so I have to close down. Well, what I want to say is that I don't find too much of this so far in the book by the extermination camps of Action Reinhardt, in quotes. I think that they have been quite good about not going overboard to apologize for the Jews, when Groff gave his three groups, and I'll have to go into this book some more, but when he gave those three groups who wanted to keep the Holocaust alive, it started out with the Jews and then went to the Poles and then went to the Allied British, American, and Russian military needs and so on. So there we go, ladies and gentlemen. The show is over so quickly. I hope it wasn't too disjointed. Sorry Bradley didn't show up, but good afternoon for now.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.